What would you consider the most challenging survival environment on Earth? Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Amply Promise podcast. My name is Chris, and today you are joining me and my best friend in the whole wide world, Mr. James D. Downey.
Hello.
As we undertake
Adventure.
Episode 132.
Question mark?
No, I'm pretty sure we're 132, aren't we?
We got one of our episodes wrong last week. I forget which one.
Oh, Jesus. It was probably the first one. We're terrible at this. Do you know what has thrown the whole thing off?
Yeah.
And I know people who listen to the podcast have probably picked up on this, but one of our uploads to like Spotify uploaded twice.
Yeah.
And then we...
It overwritten.
And then we've missed an episode, but we haven't missed an episode. There's still 132 episodes there.
because we missed one earlier or something like that.
That's what happened.
I think we're on 133.
Is it?
Yeah, 132 was The Secrets of Dumbledore last week.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Oh.
According to Spotify.
Yeah. So this is 133.
Yeah.
And we see, according to Audio Boom, it'll be like 129.
Yeah.
I hate the way it does that.
I know, but that's because we missed an episode somewhere down the line.
Okay, well, we're here today and we're getting ready because, Dee, I just asked you the question, what would you consider one of the most challenging survival environments on planet Earth? Do you, any spring to mind? If I said to you, I'm going to throw you into an environment. A desert, okay. Uh-huh, yeah. Uh-huh. Would you consider the desert more challenging to survive in than, say, the Arctic? Or say the...
Well, Christopher, technically the Arctic is a desert due to the lack of rainfall. See what I'm saying?
Stop. Stop what you're doing.
Largest desert on Earth, Chris?
It's the
Antarctica.
That's right, it is.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, fuck all it is.
That was actually a little tidbit I had to bring up during the Shackleton expedition. I forgot.
There you go. Well, we brought it up this time.
Just 4 weeks late.
Yeah. Do you know what we did last week as well, or 2 weeks ago?
Go ahead.
On the wrong episode. We talked for an excessive amount of time about how episode 131 is a significant number. It's an angel number and it does all this stuff. And that was episode 132.
Oh, jeez.
That we did all of that talking about it. So, yeah. Just when we're talking about previous episodes, that sprung to mind. But yeah.
So with all the apologies out of the road this week,
mm-hmm.
are you ready to jump into this wonderful story? I have a story. It is. I'll ruin the suspense. It is Alone in the Sahara.
Okay. Good.
And this is the survival story of Mauro Prosperi.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I talk this to you, Dee, is because Mauro, I think I'm pronouncing that right. Mauro, M-A-U-R-O, Prosperi. The reason I took this topic is I find it super interesting. This is an ultra runner
mm-hmm.
who was doing an ultra running event, got disorientated, and was left completely stranded and alone in the Sahara Desert.
Yeah, that's not what you want.
It's seriously not. So I'm going to start a little bit, Dee. The Sahara Desert is 3.6 million square miles mm-hmm. of desert.
Second biggest desert in the world, probably.
Oh my God.
Behind Antarctica.
God, you love this Antarctic fact.
It's all I got.
It's known, obviously, for its intense heat. The surface temperature of the Sahara Dunes have been measured at more than 180 degrees Fahrenheit.
Ooh, what's that in normal?
It's probably only 10. Let's be real. Like their metric system is. Are we metric? No. They're imperial.
Because 100 is 30 degrees Fahrenheit.
It's probably so. About 60 degrees. I would say.
Yeah, that's
about
insanity.
60 degrees Celsius.
Yeah, I can get it up. You keep going.
Okay. Rainfall and vegetation growth is completely minimal, and the odds of encountering another person are extremely low. It's about as close as you can get to a barren wasteland without traveling to the polar ice caps or the moon.
That's insane.
However, us humans in recent years, not even recent years, what temperature are we talking?
82.
You're joking.
82 degrees Celsius, 180 Fahrenheit.
Okay, this has just amplified the story a little bit more when I think of that. Holy smokes. Literally. 82 degrees sand. You know, sometimes you go on holidays and you stand in the sand and you're like, oh, that's hot.
Yeah.
It's probably only about 30 degrees,
yeah.
If even.
80 degrees, that's like nearly boiling point of water.
That would cook your shoes.
Yeah, and melt them.
100%, it would melt them. Goodness. But anyway, us humans in recent years have become more and more, what's the word? Enticed.
Adaptive?
Enticed by stupid challenges.
Oh yeah,
we love challenges.
Yeah.
We love doing silly things, and there's a marathon that takes place every year
in the Sahara.
It's called the Marathon des Sables,
and it sounds ominous,
doesn't it?
Yeah,
I think it's the French sable I put on that. It could be sable. But no. It's Marathon de Sable. It's been called the toughest foot race on earth, and it's a 6-day annual ultra marathon. So what happens is it covers 156 miles from point A to point B, and it takes place specifically in Southern Sahara, which is Morocco. And basically, you have to get from point to point. Each day now, it's a stage race. So you'll run maybe, first stage might be 40 miles. And you have to cover 40 miles in day one. And at the end of it, there's a tent, like a community. You sleep there. And the next day, it's up to you when you get up and you move on to day two. The catch is you have to carry everything yourself. So you're carrying all your water. There's no aid stations. You're carrying all your water, your provisions, your food, everything. And you're just trekking across just vast, open, ridiculous sand and rocks and all sorts. The marathon's website describes it as, "The MDS is a truly grueling multi-stage adventure through a mythical landscape in one of the world's most inhospitable environments. You have to be self-sufficient and carry all your own food and equipment for the week on your back. Communal goat hair barber tents are pitched every night. But apart from that, you have to take everything else with you. Water is rationed, and if you exceed the ration, you get a time penalty."
Oh, that's wild. Isn't it? I mean, like, I thought it was up, because you're carrying it with you, I thought, like, if you want to carry more weight for more water, that'll slow you down, that's kind of how it balances out, but no, you literally can't take more than the specified amount.
It's crazy. I've watched people train for this, and they train in, like, heat chambers and things like that, and it's insane. It'd be awesome to do, but it's insane.
Yeah, what a fuck, Chris.
Yeah. Anyway, this brings us to our main character, Mauro Prosperi, who was a former Italian police officer, an Olympic pentathlete as well.
Okay.
So this guy competed in the Olympics. And at the time he entered the race, he was 39 years old. He was married. He had 3 young kids. And after intense preparation, he flew to Morocco to begin the race. Now, although it draws 1,300 participants every single year, in 1994, the event only had 134 competitors on the start line.
Okay. What year is that, sorry?
1994.
Okay, so is this like early days of the event, maybe?
I think it started a good bit before that, actually, because it was well-founded at that point. It could have been like the late 80s, maybe it started, or the early 90s. I'm not too sure. Yeah, but because there was only 134 competitors on that day, Prosperi says he was on his own for most of the 6-day journey. So you picture, if you have like 1,000 like people, chances are you're going to be mixed up with a couple of people. You know, you can track together, that kind of thing. This guy was mostly on his own.
Mm.
So we're just going to jump straight into kind of where it goes wrong, because we don't need to hear about all the first days. So the day 4 of the Marathon des Sables constitutes its longest single stage, with a 57-mile trek through the desert between campsites. On April 14th, 1994, blistering sun elevated temperatures to 115 degrees Fahrenheit as Prosperi passed the third checkpoint 20 miles into today's journey. Per regulations, he picked up his allotted 2-liter ration of water and continued running. Shortly after 1 p.m., high winds brought on an unexpected sandstorm that caused organizers to pause the race for that day. Other competitors waited out the storm and eventually made for the fourth checkpoint by nightfall, but Mauro Prosperi had disappeared. The following morning, ground and air search parties were sent out to look for him. The Moroccan military and the Bedouin trackers aided in the search. However, they found absolutely no trace.
Oh, God. It's not looking good, guy.
It is not. So, Prosperi began to backtrack for hours, but it soon became too dark to continue searching for the trail markers. He made his camp and resumed search at dawn, only to find his surroundings completely unfamiliar. He had little food and almost zero water left. Following the race guidelines to remain stationary and wait for rescue, Prosperi sat on the sand dune all day. In the afternoon, he says a rescue helicopter flew almost directly above his position, but failed to notice him.
No.
The next day, he decided to begin walking again. And in a later interview, he told, "I had a compass and a map, so I thought I could navigate perfectly well. But without any points of reference, it's a lot more complicated."
Yeah, that's one thing about the desert that really freaks me out. Is like, to a certain degree, everything already looks the same. Because it's just sand.
Yeah.
Like, there's no trees. There's no like markers.
Yeah.
And then if you have like a dust storm that blows through and like reshapes all the fucking sand and stuff, yeah.
It's almost as bad as being in the ocean.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a land ocean, basically.
It's a land ocean, basically. Yeah.
You've got no points of reference. You don't know. You could think that you're walking.
You can see north.
Yeah.
Or you work out where north is, and that's all well and good. But you may have to.
And I say this having obviously never experienced a desert, but I think the best thing to do would probably be to try to navigate by night, maybe using the stars.
Yeah, I mean, just basically on the fact that you boil to death.
But it would be so cold during the night after being so warm.
True.
And on top of that, how do you last through the day to get to night to even begin? Do you know what I mean? Yeah. You'd be so depleted.
At night, are you thinking hopefully you'll find like lights, like? Possibly, fire or actually, something
yeah,
like that.
maybe. I was just thinking more so like you could find a North Star or equivalency in the southern hemisphere and just think, right, that's my point. I could move for maybe 8 hours here and hopefully come across something. But God knows. I mean, the desert is a huge place.
Yeah, exactly. Jesus. Yeah.
In the distance, Prosperi noticed what appeared to be a solitary structure. As he approached, he recognized it as a Marabout shrine, an abandoned tomb for a Muslim religious leader.
What?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Although there was no rescue to be found here, the shrine provided shade and other resources.
That's like, that is like a major find.
Huge find.
You have shade. That's like the most important thing.
So I actually have pictures of the shrine here that he found, and if I might be able to stick them onto the actual video version of this podcast. A little clip. Probably not. Like, this is the empty promise. In an attempt to stay hydrated, Prosperi sucked on wet wipes from his pack. He licked the morning dew off of rocks nearby and drank his own urine while it remained relatively clear.
You gotta do it.
He also used urine to rehydrate and cook the freeze-dried food in his pack since no other water was available. He obviously thought he was doing what was best at the time, but I think in near enough every survival case, and particularly in hot climates, it's strongly advised that you don't drink your own urine.
Oh, really?
I think whenever you get so dehydrated, your kidneys start to break down, essentially, and you're going to start drinking like the breakdown that's in the urine, and you're actually going to do more damage to yourself
than good
as you're putting the urine back in, if that makes sense.
Oh, there you go.
And it'll lead to further dehydration and basically organ failure.
Well, there you go.
If it's clear, you're pretty good, but it's not going to be
clear.
In
those circumstances, if you're like, well, I've got 3 days before I dehydrate to death, I'll take those chances. I'll survive two more days before
organ failure. Exactly. Take the other two.
Yeah.
Organ failure would be pretty grim on the best of days, but organ failure in the desert would be probably the worst.
Pretty grim on the best of days.
Yeah. Organ failure. When his food stockpiles ran out, Prosperi says he ate the bird eggs and beetles. He says he also managed to kill and consume raw bats and lizards he found near the shrine, hoping to absorb any moisture that might be removed by cooking the flesh. Anti-diarrhea medicine in his pack help him avoid losing more water despite his extreme diet. So obviously these guys can be prepared with like tablets and all this kind of stuff, for this. Yet again, an airplane passed near Prosperi's location. He says he tried to signal by lighting a small fire and writing SOS in the sand, but the plane continued toward the horizon. Distraught and suicidal, Prosperi took his pocket knife and cut his wrists.
Oh no.
In a cruel twist of fate, his dehydrated blood coagulated, so clogged basically, prevented his death.
That is insane. Imagine being at the complete end of your tether at that moment, and then you don't even get to like make that choice.
No, you've made that choice. That's it. Like, you've made that horrible decision that this is it. There's no way out for me. Do that deed, and suddenly it clogs. Yeah, it's like, you're not dying here. Like, if you're gonna die, you're gonna bake to death basically.
That's
crazy.
Jesus.
In a final attempt to reach safety, Prosperi set out from the shrine and began walking towards mountains in the distance, traveling in the early morning and late evening to avoid the heat of the day. He left pieces of his gear behind to form a trail of breadcrumbs. Although he believed the mountains to be in the direction of the marathon's trail, this route would actually take him further into the Sahara.
Yeah. Oh. That's so grim.
As he passed dry riverbeds, he squeezed liquid from any plant roots nearby. Then, after 8 days in the desert, Prosperi found a desert oasis. He spoke in it in a later interview and said, "Really, it was only a large puddle, a mirror of water in a wadi. I threw myself upon it and gulped with abandon, but I could hardly swallow. I managed to force a mouthful of it down, and almost immediately I vomited.
Oh, no.
I couldn't hold anything. I found I had to take tiny sips, one every 10 minutes. Again, it's like a cruel twist of fate. You find this, or fate, you find this water, and you're not even able to, like, all you want to do is gulp it down. Yeah.
You're so desperately in need of water. It's right there, and you can't even drink it.
Yeah.
That is like, that's what I imagine hell to be like.
Oh, yeah.
Constantly dying of thirst, but unable to drink. Yeah. Like, holy shit.
It's like one of those, what do you call those, like, horrible, like, little, like, an infinite loop of, like, torture and torment.
Yeah.
It's like, what do you call that, what do you call that, teal, that myth, the teal of, I'm gonna say it's
Hansel and Gretel.
It's like Phacelius, the guy who basically he tricked the gods into, this is years ago, a little bit off topic, but he tricked the gods years ago into the Greek gods into
I love the way you say it, years ago, as in like,
oh, like it's just a couple of years ago. Yeah. No, this is the ancient, like, this is the ancient,
this must be 1983,
an ancient teal. He tricked the gods into locking death up. So he locked death in a prison cell. And he thought with death locked up, no one would ever have to die anymore.
All right.
But eventually death broke free. And death came out after this guy. And when death finally caught up with him, he managed to trick death and escape. And the gods weren't best pleased with this, because the gods like the cycle of life and death.
Yeah.
So the gods hunted this guy down and gave him the ultimate torment. They put him in basically hell, where he was forced to roll a giant boulder up a hill. And if he got to the top, he was allowed to escape.
Right.
But every time he got to the top, the boulder would roll back to the bottom. And that's what he was forced to do in eternity. Yeah. So that's pretty cruel.
That is.
But, I mean,
this is like this.
This is like this. It all comes back around. Yeah. I knew I was going somewhere with that. I get the name of that story, because I like that story. But anyway, with his thirst finally quenched, Prosperi filled his water container and kept walking. Eventually, he found some dried up goat droppings and continued searching for more.
Yum.
The droppings led him to human footprints.
Oh.
And Prosperi recalls, I crested a hill and beheld an incredible sight. There was a nomad girl, maybe 8 years old, tending a flock in the sparse greenery of a wash. I ran towards her and begged for help. The girl was part of a caravan of nomadic Tuareg, T-A-U-R-E-G. So it's a tribe who immediately gave Prosperi goat's milk. Then took.
Like, what's your problem with goat's milk?
I'm just thinking, like, you're just. What? You're so dehydrated and you're so. Like, you want your thirst to be quenched.
Are you thinking that's going to be heavy in the stomach?
And probably warm and, like, creamy.
But it's got water, it's got fats. It's got nutrients. It's got all the nutrients
exactly. But Jesus, like, if anyone handed me any type of.
Talk about
milk,
sitting in your stomach?
Exactly. Like, Jesus. That thing would just turn to cheese.
You're just sitting there on death's door, exactly. They're like, milk, and you're like, have you got any water? Get a coffee.
I know, don't carry water, we'll carry goat's milk instead.
Well, yeah, of course, these guys know what they're doing.
I know. She then took him via camel to the nearest village. Despite starting in Morocco, Prosperi had traveled 180 miles from where he had disappeared.
Ooh, fuck.
That's an ultra and
an ultramarathon. Yeah.
Unknowingly wandering into Algeria. Local military police initially confronted him due to tensions between the two countries, but after finding out who he was, they took him to a hospital. Prosperi reportedly lost 35 pounds, weighing in at just 99 pounds when
holy
he was rescued,
shit.
Which is nothing.
Yeah.
Doctors said his liver had almost completely failed, and hospital staff gave him 16 litres of IV, of intravenous fluids.
Mm-hmm.
He was reunited with his family and received a warm welcome back to Italy, although he was unable to eat any solid food for several months after the ordeal, and he didn't fully recover for nearly 2 years.
That's insane. How many days was he out?
He was out there for 8 days before he came across anybody.
8 days?
8 days alone in the desert.
8 days in the desert, knocked you out for 2 years.
Yeah.
And you barely make it.
There is a visible scar on his wrist from his suicide attempt in the desert. And documentary teams have found, because a lot of people said, there was a lot of kind of conflict with this story when it came out, and people said, no, he made that shit up and all this kind of stuff. But people went and they found the shrine where he stayed. They found the remnants of the food he said he had, like bones and bats and stuff like that. They found his trail of equipment that he left behind. They see the scars on his wrist where he tried suicide. The survival story of Mauro Prosperi may be hard for some to believe, but by his own account, he made choices that would have reduced his chances of survival. But after 9 days, in one of the harshest environments on Earth, Prosperi narrowly made it to safety. And that is undeniably an impressive feat. And despite his lasting injuries, Prosperi remains athletic and active to this day. And he returned to finish the marathon.
I was going to say, later years. He ran his own marathon, but
he did.
He wanted to go back and actually finish the one he started. That is insane.
Just another little quick story of survival and being alone in the wild.
Well, Chris, at certain points in that story, I honestly got thought I was reading or I was listening to a fable, or something from scripture. Like, honest to God, that's what it sounds like. It's like a man in the desert. He's wandering. He's at his wit's end. Tries to commit suicide.
He's got to run upon a burning bush soon enough.
Yeah.
He's got to hear the word.
Do you know what I mean? It's like he tried to take his own life and it was prevented. Yeah. And he stumbles along and he finds an oasis.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's miraculous in and of itself. And then he stumbles on through the desert to find a nomad girl. Like, how... That is straight out of a film. Or like a vision or a dream or something. Like a girl in the desert.
It gives her milk, goat's milk.
To survive.
Unbelievable.
That's wild.
There is, if anybody who's interested in this, there's a fantastic series on Amazon called I Shouldn't Be Alive, and it's like 30-40 minute episodes of true survival stories from all over the world. And in one of the early seasons they cover that story and they actually interview Mauro Prosperi and he tells the story. It's fantastic. You should really watch that if anyone has a chance.
That is
it's a great little story.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And it kind of just puts things in perspective for all those people who take upon the Marathon de Sable, because I mean, I think obviously after that, and nowadays, like this, that was 1994. I'm pretty sure nowadays everybody is so well tracked with beacons and GPS, stuff that like something like that would nearly be impossible. But even if you were lost for hours in the desert, like it's got to be pretty grim.
That could be a death sentence in and of itself.
And if you don't have the kind of mental capabilities and the mental fortitude to keep going, you could die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Yeah, I wouldn't doubt that for a minute.
And lost in a sandstorm, you could be buried or anything in sand.
Well, that's it as well. It's like, you know, you say like everyone has like the trackers and stuff on them.
Yeah.
But like in the desert, like stuff like that, like you just, even if you knew exactly where they were, you might not be able to get to them in time.
Yeah.
You know, I can see a beacon. This is where they are on the map. We can't get to them because there's a sandstorm because we don't have the supply chain to get there ourselves.
And so many times, planes and helicopters went over his head, and he still couldn't see him. It's like being lost at sea, I'd imagine, you know? You're just a dot in the ocean or in the land ocean, basically, you know?
The ocean of sand.
But yeah, another nice story. And if anyone wants to follow that up, please check out the I Shouldn't Be Alive episode featuring Mauro Prosperi. My information for this topic came from an article from Off the Grid, so you can check that out too if you want any further reading.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah. So
survival in the desert.
Survival in the desert. D.
That's one I would not pick.
Yeah.
Personally.
No.
I would go Antarctic quicker in the desert.
I go Amazon quicker than all of them. Even though there's more things to kill you in the Amazon.
Yeah, that's the thing with the Amazon, is like it's like you don't know what's behind that tree. You don't know what's behind, you know, what's in the darkness.
You could literally, like, you could think, okay, here we go, day one, and just get bit by a snake.
What is scarier? Is it like, I don't know what's out there, or I know that there's nothing out there? Because, like, the desert in the Antarctic, it's like, there's nothing for miles and miles and miles.
I think
no other humans.
I've often said I would always take desert over Antarctic. I don't think I could deal with the cold. But we can heat ourselves up, I think, more efficiently than we can cool ourselves down.
But yeah, I don't know. In Antarctic temperatures, if you just don't have the equipment, like there's nothing. You're not doing anything to heat yourself up. Like, or you'll just die from exhaustion trying to heat yourself up.
I'd probably start like an ice hotel and charge people into it.
Yeah, that's it.
Make enough money to fly.
The way to survive, the way to like get yourself rescued, is to make the best tourist attraction possible.
It's business.
And then all of a sudden, these just like Americans land in, complaining about the service. Like that's how you get rescued.
Why is it always Americans?
I don't know.
It's not British. That's not my fault. Complainers, the Brits are way worse. I'm sorry, but you are.
Well, that's it. It depends where you are in the world. I think Americans on holiday,
the Irish just love
go more places.
Yeah.
Whereas imagine the English typically are in Benidorm.
And Britain.
In Britain. The Irish, fuck me, the Irish are the worst out of all of them.
You think so?
What do we do but complain?
The Irish go to Spain
about
and
anything,
complain about
the heat.
Yeah. Jeez, it was too warm.
And then they get back home and they go, fuck, it's freezing.
It's freezing, yeah.
Weather's miserable here.
Miserable. It's too warm to sit, actually. You couldn't enjoy yourself.
No,
too warm. Couldn't eat, couldn't drink. No.
It just sounds like we're joking, but we're serious. We hate everything.
We're made to complain. That's it. That's all we are, you know. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, thank you for tuning in to episode 132. We will see
three,
you.
Three, bye.
Oh, jeez.
I know.
Episode 133. We will see you all next week.
Bright-eyed.
And bushy-tailed with another fantastic episode. Or maybe later in this week. Who knows? We'll see what happens.
It's a mystery.
Either way, we'll see you soon. Goodbye and God bless.